Glenn, how are you doing?
Well, Marty, it's so great to talk to you again, and this is such an important time in our world and in our country, and it obviously is coinciding with the cycles work that you've been doing, and you've projected times such as these for a very, very long time, and now they're here. The world is flustered and flummoxed and wanting to know what's going on, and you are somebody who for decades now has been saying, look at this time frame because the world's going to rock and roll, and now here we are.
I know. I'm often astonished myself at how the computer could project 2016. I mean, 30 years ago. But it's economics. If you turn it up, then basically you get change. That's pretty much it. I think the biggest problem that I see, which you can let us know what you're seeing down there, but is that they are focusing on Trump as if he is the personality, rather than the fact that he is more or less the result and not the cause. That it's really kind of a vote against the establishment politicians, not necessarily that Trump is this wonderful, fantastic guy. And I think that they would rather personally say it's him rather than admit that they themselves are the ones that everybody's mad at.
Hey, listen, no question about it. I've often said that the political class, the professional political class, the donor class, the lobbyists, the staff, the elected officials that are well-entrenched are the least introspective people I've ever met in my life. It's astonishing to me, and it remains astonishing, that here we are looking at this Trump phenomenon, and then also on the Democratic side, to a somewhat lesser extent, the Sanders phenomenon. And they're looking everywhere for answers to why that is, except in the mirror. Obviously, the general public, the vox populi, is saying that the political class has failed them. And maybe the general public bears some responsibility for continuing to send back that same political class, but they don't see it that way. They feel betrayed by the political class, and they are angry and frustrated and worried about their future. And interestingly, you might have noticed a few weeks back, Senator Ben Sasse, a first-term senator from Nebraska, had said he wanted no part of being a party of David Duke and Donald Trump, and somehow they stuck David Duke and Donald Trump together there, as they stuck Hitler and Mussolini and every other character they can think of tried to tag with Donald Trump. But Senator Sasse had said in his statement, well, listen, the American people are angry, and they have a right to be. And then, which I kind of took as a platitude, a very typical platitude of a lot of the people there in Washington, because you would ask Senator Sasse to articulate, okay, Senator, what specifically do you think people have a right to be angry about? That B, what have you done in your brief Senate career to address that? And C, if we do what you say and don't elect Trump or some other outsider, and we elect some non-specified insider, what will you do differently than what you have done heretofore in order to persuade me to change my pre-led election to vote for Mr. Trump, to make me think, okay, I'll give you guys one more chance. And there's nothing of that. What they want is the Trump phenomenon to go away so that they can go back to business as usual. And that's part of why I think the general public still is just not buying what they're selling.
Now, I agree. If it's... I mean, it's amazing in the meetings that I've had that, you know, the people that know that, you know, our model has forecasted this, they're going, well, yeah, okay, fine, you forecasted, but you got to be wrong somehow. It's like, why? It's economics, and you people don't get it. And no matter what I say, or even right to their face, looking in their eyes, it's like glassed over. It doesn't sink in.
Well, I'd like to ask you, and it's interesting because the folks that you just described make a living, professional living, in one way or the other, at trying to overcome cycles. If you look at it from the perspective of Martin Armstrong, or somebody that does cycles work and thinks that the world and things happen in cycles, they think that they're the power of altering nature. So their bag of tricks isn't working, they really are flustered because a lot of their own personal experience has been, say, in the post-1987 world where you've had central bankers, you know, flooding the world with liquidity and debt as something goes wrong, and then you seem to be reaching the end of that debt super cycle here at right about the same time that your cycles weren't predicted. Look out below, things are getting ready to change, and not in a good way. But that so runs counter to what these people's thought process has been and their personal experience has been, that they would sort of be flustered. Well, what would you, if you were to talk to an open-minded policy professional, say in the Washington, D.C. area now, and there aren't too many of those, what would you say they should get ready for next?
Well, if... I can say largely what our computer is showing, and it's fascinating. No matter what markets I look at, if it's Canadian dollar, Dow Jones, whatever, we're looking at a huge spike in volatility coming in November. Now the computer doesn't know fundamentally what is happening, but it picks up cyclically the elections, which is why we're going to do our this year's WEC after the elections, hopefully maybe down in Orlando or something. But what we're looking at is just that I think there's nothing that they are prepared to accept because it's like, if they steal a dollar, nobody said anything. Okay, I'll steal $2. Nobody said anything. And they keep this up, and then they pass the 1,000, and they take 1,001, and then everybody's pissed at them. And they go, well, why? You know, you let me steal 1,000. What's one more dollar? So they don't get it because they've been doing this for such a long time. And I would say the outsider is necessary at this point. And I think we talked before why Bonner had to go. Because when you had all the Tea Party people that came in, you know, he had his little junior meeting and said, okay, fine, this is the way it works, and you will vote as I tell you. And they revolted. And he was like beside himself. This is the way we run here. I'm the dictator, and you're going to do what I tell you. And he couldn't deliver the Republican vote. But and if you put him in charge as a dictator, he would never have shut down one single agency in Washington ever. I mean, they both like the way everything is. I don't see anything but an outsider being able to actually say, no, this is duplicate, cut that, cut this, cut that, because nobody else is going to do it.
I know, when you write on your blog and then pay items that you give to subscribers and friends, you go to great lengths to separate opinion from fact, and fact as determined by the model that you use. And so you're saying what you're looking out for without speculating is that you're seeing this huge rise in volatility towards the end of this year. So, but to get into what might cause that, what might be the proximate cause of that volatility spike requires a certain amount of speculation. And with your trained eye and your trained ear, you think that sounds like it coincides with, the election of an outsider.
Well, I'm not saying that Trump wins. What I'm saying, if he doesn't win, what our computer is showing is that we may see a wholesale upheaval in Congress within 2 years. More or less kind of like the Scottish event where they threw absolutely everybody of the Labour Party out. That if they get Hillary or Cruz, or, you know, if it's Romney in there, whatever, and they succeed in stealing the election away from the people, one, they have to expose what they've done. And there's just no way to keep up this pretense that we actually have a democracy. I mean, they can change the rules. They changed the rules before to prevent Ron Paul's name from even being introduced into the...
Right.
Now, under those same rules, only Trump's name can be introduced. So they got to change the rules again. And
like they said, George Orwell said in Animal Farm, I guess it was on Animal Farm, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others.
It's just so I would say that if Trump doesn't win, the huge volatility that we're seeing is pretty much people, you know, this silent majority per se is just really pissed off, and they're not gonna take it anymore. Kind of like that you know, that old movie, you know, Madder in Hell.
Right.
But we have four elections that I've been, you know, warning people about here. It's like the year from political hell. June, we have the Brit exit, and we just had this terrorist attack in Brussels, etc. The number one issue in Britain is, what's it come down to? Do you want these people in your country, or do we, you know, we don't want them in? It's coming down to closing your border. And so the more this happens, then the higher the probability of Britain exiting. And despite all the nonsense, you know, you have, you know, Brandon and all these people, oh, you know, Britain won't be very good without Europe. No, it's the other way around. Europe fails without Britain. And, you know, you're having everybody putting up borders because they brought in like over, you know, a million of these people and they lost 600,000 of them. So, I mean, how do you know, you know, this is how the terrorists got in. And it's basically now a cancer inside of Europe that can tear it apart. You have the German election, and it certainly looks more like right wing is going to take over there, and Merkel is going to be lucky if she's just tarred and feathered on the way out. So then you have the French elections. All right, so you're looking at the potential here of turning upside down whatever used to be in your idea of political stability, completely opposite. So if Trump doesn't win, you're still going to have an electorate that's going to be madder than hell. And by the time we get to 2018, we're going to see a real major overhaul in Congress politically. So this is not going to go away. If Trump wins, maybe you got a shot at stemming some of the stuff if he actually does, you know, start, you know, saying, wait a minute, this is ridiculous, and refusing to sign things that are all the pork deals that they have down there.
Right.
I mean, it depends. I mean, it's, you know, it's hard to judge a candidate on what they say, because generally whatever they say is just, you know, pomp and circumstance, whatever. I mean, Trump, you know, is not going to be able to build a wall or force Mexico to build a wall. I mean, all that's, you know, it's very nice things to say, but people, even in the United States, are upset about the immigration as they are in Europe. And you're seeing the same thing develop in China. You know, you have the Donald Trump of China rising, starting over there as well. So this is a global trend.
Well, I can speak a little bit to what's going on in Washington right now. And in terms of the elites, if you will, the Democrat and Republican elites, and the leadership of the party and whatever apparatus is there, there's still not a general recognition, as you might suspect, of the magnitude of the turnover. And I'll give you two examples. One is on the Democratic side. Even though there are credible reports, and I spoke not long before this this conversation we're having with a retired Secret Service agent who's got plenty of active contacts within the Secret Service who say that the FBI reaffirmed the reports that many people see on the web and all, that the FBI believes they have a lead pipe lockdown case that Hillary Clinton broke the law, at least as it pertains to handling classified information, and perhaps as it pertains to pay-to-play stuff, as she was the Secretary of State, and in terms of doing things in exchange for donations to the Clinton Global Initiative by all kinds of people, up to and including foreign governments. But the Democratic elite just shrugged that off. But that's potentially calamitous. On the Republican side, right now, the thing that's going on in Congress is the budget. And so we have Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell planning to try to pass a budget, which includes all kinds of spending and other initiatives that were agreed to by Ryan and others with Mr. Obama at the end of last year. I'm going to try to honor the promises we made with Mr. Obama. Well, they can't get the votes. So, you know, the House Freedom Caucus and others won't vote with them. And at the end of the day, I don't expect the Democrats on the budget to vote with them, but at the end of the day, it looks like the track that they're on is to head towards doing nothing, 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 nothing. Then you get up late in the year. That's the time you're about the volatility, by the way, that you're projecting is coming, where the once again, a spending bill, some sort of giant omnibus spending bill gets passed, largely with Democratic votes, but with the votes of Paul Ryan and some of his cohorts. And on the Senate side, Mitch McConnell, some of his cohorts, and the deal they do with Obama, which would further inflame the fans on the Republican side. So that's currently that there is just not that recognition that the world is changing. However, I can give you another example. I spoke yesterday with a 20-year-long friend of mine who is in the lobbying political action world, who had been a Republican leadership aide for years, and for high-profile members that people would know the names. And he currently is an outside consultant for a major, major, major Fortune 500 company who is indicative of the smart money starting to get it. And they go, hey, who here can get our general counsel a meeting with Trump? They're going like, hey, we don't understand this Trump thing, but we understand something real here is going on, and we better at least hedge our bets so that we have at least a foot in the door should history get turned upside down here in November. So that's an interesting inside behind the curtain report from Washington, D.C. For this week.
Well, the other factor you have is, which I find curious, that they're actually allowing to go into the press, is that they have been investigating Goldman Sachs on rigging the Treasury bond auction, which is exactly the same thing that they took down Salomon Brothers for. And I believe that's why Goldman ended up buying both sides of the aisle, having two Treasury secretaries. They realized after Salomon was shut down, hey, they could do that to us. So the object was to take over government. That's my belief. And that's how you got, Paulson and Rubin in, and they repealed Glass-Steagall, etc. So the fact that this is now just starting to eke out, I think the New York Post had a piece on it a couple of days ago. And it's very interesting because it's setting the stage that normally, and no politician would ever, ever touch Goldman Sachs. You used to tell me, no, they all wanted to basically have a golden parachute from Goldman Sachs.
Right.
I think that the fact that this is just starting to eke out, and you have Cruz, his wife, basically a managing director of Goldman. The Clintons were bought and paid for by the Goldman crew and the rest of them up there. So the fact that this is even coming out right now is very, very interesting, because if it catches some traction, I can only see it helping Trump, not hurting.
Right. Well, can you speak a little bit, in a separate but related issue? You know, you talk about not just the cycles of the economy, but the cycles of war. And boy, you know, we see the global developments there seem to be playing right in the same time frames that you've talked about for a while. And can you talk a little bit about this, the Brussels attack and what else, other things we're seeing coming out of the turmoil in the Middle East and the immigration moving into Europe and elsewhere? And how do you think that all, where we are in that, and that will relate to economy, the economic situation?
The fact that Russia went in exactly on the day of the model on September 30th last year. Usually whatever happens on that day ends up becoming the focal point. And sure enough, what have we seen? We've seen nothing but this whole migration process has begun since then. It's really an invasion. And it's basically the decline and fall of Europe. And the Middle East is going to be critical as far as that is concerned, even economically. You're looking at all the various countries down there, Saudi Arabia starting to issue debt. With oil, you know, they had spent so much money and figured it would never end. So now, instead of, you know, $200 oil, they're looking at, you know, $40-$50 oil. So they effectively have starting to raise taxes locally, things of this nature. I mean, so you're at a sea change in the Middle East and economically, and this also, you know, helps to destabilize things. But the ISIS group, I think we published a chart on the Middle East before, and it's interesting that the areas where you had oil happened to be mostly controlled by the Shiites,
right?
Which is what the Sunni extremists here of ISIS are against. So, but they've been, you know, seizing oil fields, etc. So, you know, at the bottom line, is it really, you know, the leaders per se, are they really interested in money and using religion to further their own particular goals? Which it seems to be historically, that's what they always do. So I would say the fact that we have this massive migration, which is really an invasion into Europe, and it's tearing the EU system idea of open borders, etc., apart. France immediately shut down its borders. I'm finding it very interesting. I just found out, you know, I had put on the piece about the terrorist attack. Brussels was exactly 4.3 months from the Paris attack. Now, all of a sudden, they're saying, yes, the two cells are linked. So it's like a fingerprint. They each group will have its own particular cycle, just like a country or a market or whatever. And so I don't see where we're going to be doing very much but looking at the war cycle and going into particularly about 2018. This is not going to get better. It's only going to get worse. And I think you'll probably end up seeing Russia having to come back in. And he pulled out exactly on the Pi Day after going in. So that was curious, too. But, I mean, you have the PM of Hungary coming in, admitting that this is, you know, Europe has failed. It's a complete disaster. And if Britain votes to exit, you're going to see that primarily rise up in all the other countries. And this terrorism they're closing theirs, and you can't blame them. And you're seeing the same, you know, idea. Anytime the economy goes down, they always go against immigrants, always. So, you know, saying that Trump's a bigot or whatever, this is standard operational procedure. The American people, regardless of what European, American, you know, Chinese or whatever, the Chinese had the Boxer Rebellion against all foreigners. I mean, it's standard throughout history. So it's not something that the political class may think that he's a bigot and he's raising. No, he's just basically articulating what a lot of people feel.
Yeah, no question. You had that in the wake of the terrorist attack or there in Brussels. It just underscored whatever, however inartfully Mr. Trump describes some of the problems and the solutions. People say, you know what, I may not be comfortable with Trump or a thing or two or five about what Trump has to say and the way he has to say it, but if I have to choose between Trump and the status quo, I'll take Trump every day of the week, because the status quo appears to be leading to disaster. So I guess that's the way you end up big political changes end up manifesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to say that, he's a bigot and against all the Islamic, okay, during World War II, did we put all the Japanese in internment camps? I mean, this is not something new, you know, that you can just, in my opinion, that you can just blame Trump. He's not saying anything abnormal from a cyclical standpoint that always goes hand in hand when you turn the economy down. So if it wasn't him, it would be somebody else.
I know our time here is limited by your busy schedule. So one of the things I know that people that listen to you and read you are interested in is you know, actionable items that they themselves can take protect themselves and their families and their businesses and maybe their small communities in the wake of these larger trends that are going on. And the two things I'd like to ask you about are, one is you've got this whole inflation versus deflation debate where you've got the natural deleveraging forces of the marketplace versus the central bankers. And where do you think that stands? And people want to know also, as an extension of that, where do you think on things like the stock market and the precious metals, where we are in these undulations of your cycles?
Well, I think, to put it bluntly, the theories of inflation are bogus. They're mixing things up. And it's like I say often, Tom, everybody that's ever eaten a carrot has ultimately died, so obviously carrots are lethal, you know? It's the same thing. What they have to understand is that there are two types of booms. All right, there's the inflationary boom of like 1980 is a demand boom. All right, people are actually out buying stuff. All right, and why are they buying it? They were hoarding toilet paper and stuff like that going into 1980 because the perception was spend your money now because it's only going to cost you more tomorrow. When you're in a deflationary mode, you keep increasing the money supply, you can't change it because you have to have the confidence of the people. And you're not going to create that boom as long as you're in a deflationary aspect and you're not looking at it from a bottom line view. It's, you know, yeah, okay, fine, I can say, Glenn, here, I'm going to give you $1,000, but you got to give me $950 back. So what did I give you? You know, and this is the way. You keep raising these taxes, but you think you can overcome that by increasing the money supply. But the problem we have is that the country is, you know, the monetary system today is porous. It's not a domestic economy as it was in the 1800s. All right, so China sold all its 30-year bonds in and reduced their maturity down, you know, to below 5. It's porous. You have all the, you lowered interest rates, so that the pension funds then, you know, they need 8%. So what do? They start buying all the emerging market debt. To sell the debt to them, they issued it in dollars. So then they took on foreign exchange risk. And the whole thing is not, it's a very poor situation. So the ideas of inflation and money supply, they have been proven absolutely dead wrong. And it's because it's not a closed economy. We're in a global economy. Money can flow very rapidly from one place to another. So it's the dollar, you know, the Fed has increased the money supply, fine. But it didn't have any impact because effectively the dollar has become the world currency. The euro basically shot itself in the head. Japan keeps its economy closed, so the bulk of its debt is really owned by the government. All right, and everything else, basically, you know, if you're talking about Russia or China, they're not quite ready for prime time from a standpoint of can institutional money park in Chinese government bonds. No, they don't feel comfortable in doing so. So the only game in town is still the dollar. So we're not at that point where the boom is going to take place yet. That comes when confidence in government declines. That's what this Trump thing's about. So I think we're still treading water in most of this stuff as people are confused trying to figure out what's happening. And then all of a sudden, maybe Trump wins or maybe Trump loses, you know, but we have these four elections, and what you're looking at is the collapse in confidence in government. When you do that, that is what the boom type into 1980 was about. You didn't trust the dollar. You didn't trust the government. You thought, let me get rid of this stuff because it's only going to cost me more tomorrow. We're not in that mindset yet. When we are, then you're going to see that stuff take off.
By that stuff, you mean precious metals.
Metals, stock market, you know, don't forget the stock market crashed in 74, also made its low. Gold and the stocks went up into 1980 together. The difference is gold peaked in 1980, the stocks went up a little bit more, and then based and then took off. And the primary difference is gold is for the individual. It doesn't pay income, and it costs money to store it. So a pension fund can't really use it. Institutional investors can't use it. They can buy, for example, you know, gold stocks or something like that. They need income. You know, people are going to judge their performance. How much did you make this quarter? All right, they need income. And so, you know, the bulk of your money is still going to be going into the stock market. And that's why, you know, the stock market is going to go up rather dramatically. But, you know, people keep perceiving that this has got to be a one or the other situation. And historically, you just look at it, it's not true.
Well, you have eloquently spoken before of Herbert Hoover's admonition during the Great Depression about capital being like a cannon on a ship, going from one side of the deck to the other during a storm, trying to find safety and return. And so it sounds very similar to that in many ways.
Yes, that's what happens. And I thought he did describe it very eloquently, because once you undermine that confidence, then, you know, what happens? I mean, you have these pension funds, etc. A lot of them are going to go into major defaults because you have all sorts of regulations. I mean, I think even in Switzerland, like 80% of a pension fund must be in government bonds. Okay, what happens when the government goes bust? You're talking about a wholesale undermining of everything we thought that was stable. So pension funds are in serious trouble, and this is, you know, a systemic problem that nobody's looking at, And I mean, you know, I worked down on Capitol Hill back in the 80s trying to save Social Security, and I just gave up. I mean, nobody would do it. And I said, listen, we privatized this. We set it up. We actually invest the money. The Dow was 1,000. I mean, I couldn't get, I worked with both sides, with Dick Armey and everyone. And it was just like nobody would really vote for this, because then they all wanted to be able to pick and choose who the fund managers were going to be if politics changed. I said, you know, this is not putting in your brother-in-law. So I just gave up.
Yeah. Well, the thing we do appreciate that you do, and I speak for myself and a lot of others, that you in fact, you haven't given up, but what you've given up is trying to convince knuckleheaded policymakers to do the right thing, but you haven't given up on individuals and firms and people who do have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, and that are looking for ways to take care of themselves. And that may be a minority of the general population, but you're still talking about millions and millions of people who are at least interested in trying to find out what the truth is and do something to protect themselves and defend. And you're a great resource to myself and to many others, and we all appreciate that very much.
Well, thank you. But I mean, it's also a realization that the only thing that's going to change it is the masses. That's it. All right, so unless you educate the masses, then you'll change the leadership, but it's those that are in power are never going to look in that mirror and say, oh, shit, it's me. They're just not going to do it.
Well, I think you're, unfortunately, sadly, I think you're right. And I myself have tried to get on a little different course in life here a little bit to not to withdraw from the world, but to try to spend more time saying, how do you help people that are interested in figuring out what to do to navigate these things and to be a part of that, like you are, be a part of that solution. That's a solution that really will work for real people that want to find, they're looking for a lifeboat.
Well, historically, we have two choices. One, we either go into like a complete dark age, or we can maybe save it. But it's going to take major reform to do so. And, you know, it's one of those focal points in history where you come up to this stuff. And, you know, and I'm hoping that this time maybe we can move towards a democratic system, whereas the last time on the 309-year cycle was we got rid of monarchy, and then we went, I think wrongly, to a republic. And, you know, then the one before that, you're looking at ending the Dark Ages or the, you know, the Middle Ages, and you're coming out back into capitalism. So this is our third shot. I'm hoping we go towards a democratic type of solution. But, you know, there have been plenty of Dark Ages throughout history because you can't, you know, rationally come up with anything, and everybody's trying to, you know, steal the same, you know, bar of soap at the hotel room. So,
well, that's encouraging, but that's a good analogy. You know, I've often thought that our system as it currently is constructed is like you have a 100-seat airplane, and there are 1,000 people outside that all have a ticket that says they've got a seat. But somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. In this case, a lot of somebody's will lose. But so hopefully, you know, you and others we can all work together to at least increase the number of seats on that plane and mitigate the damage done to those who don't get the ride they thought they were going to get. But maybe we can come up with something that's a little more acceptable.
At this point, it is game over.
Well, on that happy note, Martin Armstrong, thank you very much for allowing me to join you again here today.
Well, look at it this way. It can be happy if we get the correct change.
That's right. That's right. Well, let's all do what we can to work towards that and then prepare. You know, like the Russians say, hope for the best, but plan for the worst.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, thanks for joining us, Glenn. It was very nice that you could chip in from your perspective down there.
Thank you, sir.
All right, I will talk to you again soon.
Great.